The following commentary is based on the teachings of Paramhansa Yogananda. In the Gospel of St. John, chapter 20, we read the inspiring account of Jesus' resurrection. The first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early, when it was yet dark, unto the sepulchre, and seeth the stone taken away from the sepulchre. Then she runneth and cometh to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and saith unto them, They have taken away the Lord. Then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus and stood in their midst and said unto them, Peace be unto you. The resurrection of Jesus, doubted by many but affirmed by those who were close to him, was a miraculous event, though one not unique in history, for many great saints of other religions have appeared to their disciples after death. Sometimes their appearances have been, as that of Jesus was, in flesh and blood form, and not only in vision. Paramhansa Yogananda relates in Autobiography of a Yogi the account of his guru Sri Yukteswar's resurrection after his earthly passing. Miracles of this type are revealed only rarely to the masses, but accounts of them related by men and women of reputed truthfulness have inspired many devotees with faith in the reality of subtler than material states of existence. Resurrection, Yogananda explained, means transformation ultimately from any lower state of being to a higher one. Worldly consciousness cannot imagine such transformation except in terms of, perhaps, an improvement of the present mess of pottage with the addition of a new flavoring. Divine consciousness, however, is capable of taking the base metal of worldliness and transforming it into the spiritual gold of divine wisdom and love. In keeping with this truth, the Bhagavad Gita in the 9th chapter tells us, Ah, ye who into this ill world are come, fleeting and false, set your faith fast on me, fix heart and thought on me, adore me, bring offerings to me, make me prostrations, make me your supremest joy, and undivided unto my rest your spirits shall be guided. Thus through Holy Scripture God has spoken to mankind. I would like to read also from Whispers from Eternity. Thank you. Master's prayer poem, Come to Me, O Christ, as the Divine Shepherd of Souls. O Christ, thou rarest flower of hearts, thou didst sail on the storm-tossed lake of prejudiced minds. Its evil-scented, gloomy thought-waves lashed thy lily-tender soul. They crucified thee with their evil, yet thou didst shed the aroma of goodness and forgiveness, and didst help them to be purified by remorse, so helping them to become attractively sweet-scented with thine all-loving flower soul. O thou great lover of error-torn brothers, an unseen monument of the mightiest miracle of love was established in each heart when the magic wand of thy voice uttered, Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Thou hast healed the cataract of hatred, and now we have grown to see, love thine enemies as thyself, for they are thy brothers, though sick and sleeping. Thou hast taught us not to increase their delirious kicks of hatred by battering them with the bludgeons of revenge. Thine undying sympathy hath inspired us to heal and wake our brothers, suffering from the delirium of anger by the soothing salve of our forgiveness. Thy crucifixion reminds us of the daily crucifixion of our fortitude by trials, of our wisdom by ignorance, of our self-control by the scathing hands of temptation, and of our love by misunderstanding. Thy test on the cross proved the victory of thy wisdom over ignorance, of thy soul over flesh, of thy happiness over pain, and of thy love over hatred. So are we heartened to bear our crosses bravely and pleasantly. Teach us to pour out sweetness when crucified by harshness, to bear with calmness the assault of worries, and to give understanding in unceasingly to those who unjustly hate us. O Shepherd of souls, wandering hearts are of themselves seeking the one fold of divine devotion. We have heard the ever-calling music of thine infinite kindness. Our one desire is to be at home with thee, to receive the cosmic Father with joyous open eyes of wisdom, and to know that we are all sons of our own one God. Teach us to conquer the Satan of dividing selfishness, which prevents the gathering of all brother souls into the one fold of spirit. Calling to one another by the watchword, love him who loves you, and love all who love you not, let us rally beneath the canopy of the universal sense of Christ oneness. Om, peace. Amen. The crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus are one of the most powerful symbols in religion everywhere. It's a universal symbol. It's not particular to Christians, and it doesn't denote, the cross does not note suffering, but challenge and ultimate victory, as we find on Easter Sunday. The universality of this cross goes way back in history. Master explained it as a cross between the upward spiring aspiration of the soul and the outward movement, which can be taken to mean two things. One, a desire to bring truth to the world. The other is to be involved in the world and therefore to receive its misunderstanding and crucifixion. Both are true. The aspiration is that which all of us have who were alive in this world. Because as one monk was told, he asked Master once, will I ever fall from the spiritual path? Master answered, how could you? Everyone in the world is on the spiritual path. We cannot but be on the spiritual path, even if we're the worst sinner. Even the greatest mafioso, these things are relative to this outward relationship, which we can get awfully confused sometimes. But beneath that, there is always the soul. We are all children of the same God. And within us, there is an aspiration towards something which, unfortunately, for a greater or lesser time, but let's be honest, it's a greater time, really, in everybody's case, is a desire for itself. And everybody in the world, every creature, wants the same basic things. Master explained it very basically and very simply. To escape pain and find happiness, it's that simple. Except that we think that pain means something that it isn't. And we think that happiness means something that it isn't, and therein lies our confusion. We think that pain means our neighbor is treating us badly. We think, in fact, that pain means crucifixion. And people so pity Jesus for having been crucified. Well, after all, yes, it's a pity, but there were thousands of people crucified, and are they sorry for them? No. Why are they? And they don't mind persecuting their neighbors. What a pity Christ was crucified. Why was it a pity? It wasn't a pity as far as he was concerned. It was a pity for the simple reason that Jesus explained up on the hill when he looked down on Jerusalem and said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how that killest the prophets, how often I would have saved you, like a mother hen gathering in her brood, and ye would not." And it will continue so until you come to the point where you can say, "Blessed is he who cometh in the name of the God of the Lord." Blessed is he who understands that God can come to people, that God is evident, and that whatever we see in life should be should cause in us a gratitude to God for all the blessings. But no, we don't say blessed is that which comes in the name of God. We say blessed is that which comes to us, me, me, me. And we get a completely wrong handle on it. And so we think that suffering, and the suffering we want to escape, is people's mistreatment of us, misjudgment of us, persecution of us, all sorts of things. This world is a complete confusion as far as those values are concerned, which you place on that kind of level. I mean, just think of a tiger in the underbrush leaping out and grabbing a peasant for his lunch. Is it bad or is it good? Well, we say it's bad. It's good for the tiger. How do you know? How can you define good and evil in such superficial terms? But there is something that makes it good or evil. That which brings us away from that which we ourselves want, and that which brings us closer. And whereas the tiger is not enough evolved to know that what he really wants is God, his soul behind that does know. Everybody's soul has this desire for happiness, but then they confuse happiness too. And they think happiness means wealth, money, power, destruction of enemies, all sorts of outward things. Religion, finally, is an inward factor, an inward reality. You, in your soul, want that happiness which never changes, which never can be destroyed, which cannot be burned or cut or divided, that happiness which is eternal, which endures, and which is ever new. Shankaracharya explained it as Satchidananda, and Master explained that as ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. That's what we all want. But the mafia capo thinks, oh boy, I'll get it if I can get more money. I can get it if I can destroy those filthy enemies, and so on. Well, we see it all around us. Why blame the mafiosi? It's everywhere. It's the delusion of mankind. But when somebody comes and says, no, it's God, then if people can say, blessed is that. Blessed is that which reminds me of God, not just the person, but all over the world you find attempts to bring about perfection in a worldly way. Bring about earthly perfection. Bring about a thought of a paradise in this world. Many people start communities with the thought that we'll create a paradise on earth. You cannot do so. It's not findable in this relative world. Everything is constantly shifting. It's like trying to say to the waves, okay, now you've got the just exactly right aesthetic shape, stop. They won't, they'll just keep going. There was a thought that if you could make, if you could bring all sorts of computers into the act and cause a series of the alphabet to sort of scramble itself in an infinite number of ways and continuously, you might conceivably reach the point where suddenly there was on the screen or on a huge screen, the Bible, just as it is. Well, it wouldn't last more than a nanosecond. Everything is changed. You cannot achieve perfection because it all changes. As the Greek saying used to be, pantare, everything is change. Now, given that, what we need to realize in our lives is not, why does this have to happen? You can be jolly well sure it does happen, will happen, cannot but happen. If there's anything that can go wrong, it will. Yes, that Murphy's Law is perfectly right. The only thing is it doesn't stay wrong. The next day it gets right again, and it's always going up, down, inside, outside, sideways, all doesn't matter. You have to finally reach the point where, wait a minute, I guess this world is never going to be perfect. Let me find that inside. You can't. Don't hate anybody because they're doing something wrong. Don't hate people. I know we've been involved in this legal battle for 11 years with SRF. Don't hate them. Don't. And I know you don't. And that's what makes me so proud of you. Because the most important thing of all is that even though we know we have to stand by our principles, and though Arjuna, who didn't want to fight, at the end of the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he says, I won't fight. And then Krishna begins to explain to him why. It is necessary to stand for the truth, because in this relative world, you can't always be pacifist. You have to be firm. You have to be outspoken. And people who think otherwise are merely thinking wishfully. But when you understand that although the teachings of Christ are crucified all the time, his truths are crucified, his consciousness is crucified, every time you speak an unkind word, you are crucifying Christ. Every time you say, I'm sorry, you're beginning to resurrect yourself. Every time you say, oh, I love this person, because God is in him, don't love him for a personality. If you love personalities for this quality, that quality, and the other one, you will automatically not love people who do not express those qualities. You have to then understand that it isn't for people's personalities that you must love them, but because every one of them is a manifestation of the same one beloved Lord. Thus, when we want to love people, let us first love him, and in that love, love others. Not love them as friends, until you can reach the point where you say you can love them as enemies too. That whether they are friends, whether they are enemies, that natural human impulse to love your friends, there's nothing wrong with it. It's inevitable, it's proper. But to be able to love your enemies helps you to realize, brings you to the realization that what you are loving is not the human being at all, but that manifestation of God. And naturally you will love more those who manifest more of God, and therefore anybody who rejects somebody who beautifully manifests God, as Jesus did, is really out of tune with God. But nonetheless, it must be God that you love. And if there is a person who is a murderer and a thief and all sorts of evil things, then love him for his potential, if nothing else. Because all of us have the potential to be better. You remember that story of St. Francis of Assisi. There was a time when he went away and left the monastery in charge of one of the brothers there. And at that time, there were three men in Assisi who were creating a great deal of problem, great many problems for the townspeople of Assisi. And finally, in outrage, they took their pitchforks and whatever else they had to hand and chased those men who ran for shelter to the monastery. And the head monk there, whom Francis had left in charge, was outraged that they would come to a place of spirituality when That was the last place they ought to go. How could they show their faces before God? How could they come to a divine place, a consecrated place, with their sins on their shoulders? And he drove them out with imprecations. And when St. Francis came back, this monk in outrage declared how he had talked to these men and what an outrage it was that those people, those three men, had come even to their holy place. Well, St. Francis was outraged, but not with those men, with that monk. He said, "You owe it to your vow of obedience to go and fetch them here." And so they went. He went, and after a lot of effort, he found them, and he brought them back. And the first thing St. Francis said was, "Brothers, brothers," what a beautiful thing to say to people who have no sense of brotherhood toward anyone, but St. Francis did. And he said, "Why do you live the way you do? You're not happy. In making other people unhappy, you're making yourselves more unhappy than anyone." And he began, and he continued, talking in this vein, thinking in terms of their needs. And bit by bit, they began to feel, first of all, so touched by his love, his divine love. Secondly, so moved by the self-revelation that he had offered them, that they not only asked for forgiveness, but entered that monastery as monks. And it is said that they died a very holy death. It's that kind of love that will change ourselves and other people's. And if we crucify Christ, crucify not just his teachings, but his consciousness, by the slightest hatred, by the slightest unkindness, remember whom you're betraying, and remember finally, and most important of all, that Christ is not somebody who lived 200 years ago. Christ lives in your own heart. God is center everywhere, a master said, circumference nowhere. You're betraying yourself, or you're blessing and resurrecting your own self, depending on how you think, how you behave, on the degree of your devotion and the purity of your own heart. You owe it to yourself to be happy. You owe it to yourself to avoid that which makes you unhappy. You know, you owe it to yourself, therefore, no matter how true people treat you, to love. Not just love in return, just love. Before they act, after they act, just love. Whatever people do to you, love. But love Christ. I remember this beautiful soul in Calcutta, in the Yoga Dhammat, and he had only one word that I ever heard him say. You'd think it was a fairly limited conversation, but it was so beautiful. Anything you said, he would say, "Guru, Guru." And you know, last I heard of him, he was levitating in Germany somewhere. That may sound ridiculous, but I don't mean he levitated to Germany and was seeing, "Oh, there he is." People in Germany invited him, and he was there, and he was seen levitating. And he was a very holy soul, driven out by the usual corporate misunderstanding. But God doesn't care about corporations. God doesn't care about organizations. God cares about each individual soul. Master said, remember, you have to individually make love to God. And the resurrection of Jesus in a physical body, yes, it was a great drama. It's not the first one, not the last. There have been many stories. There were stories about Yogananda. But beyond that, resurrection, as Master said, means any beneficial and uplifting change. Anything that you feel you have fallen into, any error you feel you have made, remember, that's your self-crucifixion, but there always lies 3 days later even. That means very soon, if you let it be. There always is resurrection. Have faith in your own potential. I don't mean have faith in your own stupidity. I mean have faith in your potential. No matter what you do, don't hate yourself for it. That's delusion working through you. Delusion does. Satan does. And Satan is a reality. It's a reality of the divine consciousness. I was reading recently letters of Master to Rajashi, St. Lin. And it was so heartrending to see how Master, as he himself put it, why do I have to worry about so much opposition, having to worry about how to gather money to face this and make SRF a secure organization, doing so many things when I need to write these books, when I can't do what I was meant to do? How can God, it was Satan, yes, but after all, God works through Satan. How can these things be? How can it be? Just for an example, Sri Yukteswar said when he met Master, I make you the heir of all that I have. He wanted that. He tried for it. Then why didn't he write a will? It was whatever he wrote was contested successfully. Traitors, one traitor of Master came to the judge there when his Sri Yukteswar's relatives tried to get the land and said, I think you ought to look into this Yogananda will. The judge thought, well, if his own co-disciple has this thought, then how can we not assume that there's something wrong? And so they didn't give it to him. Now, how can God allow things like that? How many times Master tried to get the work secure and established in India? But you know, in a way, God doesn't really care. He's got this whole thing to work out. He doesn't really get behind. I've heard of process theology, in which God himself doesn't really know. It's just always evolving. Well, I don't see it that way at all. I see that God has a great ocean in which the waves rise and fall, and which is a great cyclic movements in time. And it's not really, the whole divine story is not one team fighting another team and everybody cheering on the sidelines for one team and all the demons on the other side cheering for the other side. It isn't like that. It's really the story of each individual soul. We must resurrect ourselves in God. That's what it's really all about. In the meanwhile, we need to work for God. In the meanwhile, we need to serve him as best we can. But even God won't always be on our side when we're right, because we need, as Master said to me more than once, living for God is martyrdom. Don't think he's going to come in and save the day all the time. He'll often do so, and usually seems to pull you out at the last moment. And in fact, if we look back over the history of Ananda, which is now, 33 years old, we can see so many miracles that could not have happened without divine intervention. Sometimes I wonder if it isn't because I'm so weak and Master was so strong that God does save the day. Sometimes it seemed like he didn't save the day for Master. And yet, in the end, it's worked out. In the end, I do seriously believe that Ananda is carrying on his message. I believe that with all my heart. But what does it matter anyway? Our job is to love God and to open ourselves to him and let him do what he will. Because indeed, in the end, we will see, looking back, that there was a war between light and darkness, greatly heightened in these days, but that in the end, the light has to win. It isn't a final victory because life goes on. The earth goes on. Humanity goes on. Nothing's final. But there is, will be, a great leap forward toward living more in God and less in matter consciousness. This is what resurrection is really all about. Let us seek to be resurrected in our own love for God.